Hey, Immigrantly family, this is Sadia Khan back with another conversation that hopefully will let you think through, sit with, and learn from. We hear a lot about the creator economy, influencers talking about politics and the future of America, calling out the establishment on both sides, and they are gaining traction. I follow some of them. I like bite-sized conversations on Instagram to get the message across. And I'm sitting down with one who could be classified as an influencer, but he's so much more than that. And I'm quoting his Instagram bio here. Just a dude who works on political stuff. He grew up in San Francisco's Mission District. His dad was a Marxist activist. His mom ran a Planned Parenthood. He went on to work for Senator Dianne Feinstein, became a senior aide to Dr. Jill Biden, served in the White House, and worked on the Kamala Harris campaign. That's an impressive resume. And then Democrats lost in 2024. Something in him snapped. He pointed a camera at himself and started talking. Within 4 months, he had built over 200,000 followers on Instagram. Today, he's at more than 359,000. Charlie Goldenson is our guest. So without further ado, let's jump right in. Welcome, Charlie. I am so glad you responded to my DM because I've been following you on Instagram and I saw you as an influencer. You don't like that label. Tell me why not.
I think it's not that I don't like it. And I want to be very respectful to any creator, influencer. Like, it's not a piece of judgment. I think it's my own ego thing that I'm trying to get over. You know, before I started making content myself, and my content is very political focused, my career has always been in politics and at high level of politics, in government, in presidential campaigns. I worked as a senior aide on a winning presidential campaign for Biden. I was in the White House briefly. And so I think it's an ego thing of like, I've had to accept that even with this kind of what I viewed as like a very successful career in politics, the thing that has really taken me over the edge is me like ranting into my phone, right? And so it's just more that I'm trying to accept that and just be like, yeah, like I'm doing this, it's working, people know me for that, and I need to like be okay with that.
And full disclosure, when I started following you, I did not know your credentials or your resume. And when I started doing research for this interview, I was like, oh my gosh. But your bio is also very short. It says, and I can quote here, dude working on political stuff. Why not elaborate there?
I'm in the midst of trying to find the right equilibrium and balance. One of the core intentions of my content is to make not just politics, but progressive politics more accessible to people who maybe aren't seeking out politics, who I always describe as kind of like the people on the edge, right? They're not, maybe they're not Republicans, but like maybe they're not diehard Democrats or progressives either, but they are susceptible to new types of messaging. And I think the reason that I don't cover my profile and my credentials is because I don't want to come off as like a political guy to everybody. I don't want people to feel like, oh, well, like, here's this fucking political consultant who like worked for Biden and like, oh, like fuck that guy. Like, no, I want to lean into my identity, which is like a dude. You know? And yet, like I'm saying, you know, this is all relatively new. This is all that's kind of happened in the last year. And so I say that. And yet I'm also still trying to understand how to intentionally ensure that I am sprinkling my credentials in so that when people question me or when they think like, all right, like who's this fucking guy telling me what's going on in the world, who's like walking down the streets of the Lower East Side, I can remind them like, I also worked in the White House. I've also won presidential campaigns. Like, I do kind of know what I'm talking about, or my opinions are actually grounded in a foundation of experience. Let's remember that, right? And that's not me trying to say I'm smarter or more important, but I do
Maybe you are. Why not? Well, let's own it.
Yeah, but I do think the internet right now, and it's not a bad thing. I think, you know, I've talked about this with a lot of people in our space, whether it's media, journalism, or politics, is not that I think we're dying to go back to traditional media, but one of the things that has not switched over from traditional to new media is when you think about a panel on CNN, or you think about a panel on Fox or MSNBC or whatever, whether it's today or 20 years ago, those panelists were or are made up of elected officials or former elected officials, and like journalists, accredited journalists, or political operators who worked on campaigns, people who are active consultants and strategists. And when we shift over to the new media space, I think that that last group, I can really only name on one hand those types of commentators, people who aren't just brilliant political thinkers, but actually have a professional foundational experience working in politics. And so that's what I'm trying to bring over, right? Is I'm trying to say, like, I'm giving you my opinions. I also want you to understand that this comes from decades of experience doing this work.
Yeah, but your opinions are resonating because you don't find those opinions in mainstream media, right? So authenticity is at the core of what you're trying to do. And those conversations are resonating with people. But I've also noticed your cadence. You record things while walking. Is that a deliberate choice? Is there a story behind that?
The story really is just that, like, I think better when I'm moving. If I'm on a conference call, I'm like walking around. And I've always been like that since I was a little kid. There's clips of me playing sports where, like, in between plays, my friends are like making fun of me and the parents are laughing because I'm like moving around. I'm just really bad at staying still. And I have found that I've tried, you know, when I sit and shoot something, it's much more uncomfortable for me. The ideas are harder for me to get out. Versus when I'm moving, I think there's like some kind of subtle distraction happening that allows me to like flow freely. And it doesn't hurt that visually, I think it's more interesting. It actually benefits the content. There's more going on. It's a better hook. And I think it helps bring people in.
You mentioned growing up. Let's go back to your childhood. I read somewhere your dad is a Marxist activist. Your mom was a director at a Planned Parenthood. That's progressive roots, right? That's progressive ideology within that household. What did home feel like politically? What were the conversations that were happening at dinner table?
And I would just say, when I'm sure my dad will listen to this, I don't know if he would describe himself as a Marxist activist, but I think that's that was his world. He was a radical activist, artist, educator.
In fact, let's take a step back, sure. Charlie, because people sometimes don't understand these words.
Sure.
And we've seen this, especially on social media. Explain to me, what does that mean?
So my dad grew up in New York. He grew up on the Upper West Side and then in Jersey. He moved to San Francisco basically during the Vietnam War, was a musician and anti-Vietnam War activist. Whether my dad would describe himself again as Marxist today, you know, he was a anti-imperialist, anti-colonial, fairly anti-capitalist artist and activist. And he believed and believes, as do I, that the market systems, the business systems, the economic systems that we exist within are fundamentally broken systems that are not built necessarily for the benefit of people at their core. This is now me speaking from my own opinion, that they are ultimately built for the benefit of capital, of money. And so my home, back to your question, everything was political. Politics just was. Everything was understood within the context of politics. To the point, though, when I was a kid, it drove me crazy. I was like, you're so annoying. Like, stop talking about politics. Not everything. There was a joke that we had growing. We still make this joke today, which is that back in the day, it didn't matter if we were watching a baseball game or watching The Simpsons or doing something in the, like, for my dad, the joke was, it wasn't a joke for him, it was a joke for me, that it didn't matter where the conversation started. If my dad was speaking, it would end with him blaming Dick Cheney. That was what it was, you know? And so I never thought of politics as like its own thing. Politics is the foundation of everything. Politics simply means understanding the structures, the infrastructure that is built around us that maintains and creates the systems that shape our everyday life, whether it's what we eat, whether it's who we talk to, whether it's where we live, whether it's how much money we're making, whether it's the stop sign in your neighborhood. Like, that is all politics. I understood that growing up, and it wasn't until I got older that I really appreciated growing up in a family like that.
So let's talk about the pivot, because you said it used to bother you a lot. And I see that in my household. So I have two girls. My husband, sure, he talks about politics, but not to the extent that I do. And like your father, I make everything about politics. I am hyper aware of the messages in the media, on TV, on podcasts. It's like, okay, this is what they are trying to say. For my husband, sometimes it gets too much. It's almost overwhelming for him. Because he's a management consultant, he looks at things in a very different light. But for you, as a kid, you felt annoyed, you thought it was too much, and then pivot happens. You gravitate towards politics.
Yeah.
What was the trigger for that? Or was it just slow burn?
No, I think it was Donald Trump. I think it was Trump and Bernie Sanders, I think is what it was.
Ah.
I am 32. I was... You know, the first Trump election was 2016. I graduated college in 2016. And so I started college in 2012. I started college studying business. And because I just kind of, I went to like a very, I'm Jewish. I grew up in a very lower middle income family, but I went to a very kind of like rich kid school. And I was around a lot of finance dads, consultant dads, and a lot of Christian Catholic kids too. And a lot of my friends, who are still dear friends of mine, went off and studied business. They went off and studied finance. And I was a kid. I was an athlete. I didn't think much about what I wanted to study. And so I was like, okay, I guess that's just what you do. You go and you study business. And I remember sitting in my first class in college, like BA 101, and within minutes thinking to myself, oh, fuck. Like, I don't care. This is so boring. Like, how am I going to care about any of this? My grades were shit when I was studying business. It was really hard for me to care. I pivoted over. I started taking more political science and applied economics and economics classes and loved it. But that was also in parallel, that was like sophomore year, when Trump announced that he was running for president, right? And all of a sudden, as I was coming of age and growing up and becoming more aware, fascism was arriving as well. And so and then on top of that, I was introduced to Bernie Sanders. Bernie was an exceptionally radicalizing figure for me, not just his politics, but the possibilities that he represented of there is a completely different way to think about this. And it's not just happening in like your local DSA subgroups. It's happening at the national level too. I think that was kind of the trigger of somebody I hated that I viewed as a monster, a fascist that I still do, combined with a leader who I felt was preaching the gospel. I was like, this language, these policy positions, a theory, a political theory of empathy and care that really aligned with how I grew up. You know, I didn't even think about it. It just started. I just fell into it basically and never fell out of it.
But your first job was with Dianne Feinstein.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
You've talked about how you've worked within upper echelons of the Democratic establishment.
Yeah.
And when I think of Dianne Feinstein as a Muslim woman, I have a lot of thoughts on a lot of Democrats, including her. She symbolizes Democratic stagnation. And you, as a progressive, started working with her. I assume your ideology did not align with hers. What was it like going to the office every single day or however many times you went and feeling that disalignment?
Well, I would say yes to all of that. What I would say, though, is when I started working with Feinstein, with Senator Feinstein, it was right after I graduated. I'm saying this as like a privileged white guy, I guess, is within my political purview, at that moment in time, everything was kind of operating within this, like, we're doing all we can to fight Trump. Versus, because Bernie had already lost at this point, right? That kind of like macro hope feeling of like a new world is possible had disappeared. And now it was like, we have to do what we can to stop this guy. And so as a 22-year-old or as a 23-year-old who, you know, I wasn't a senior advisor, I was a child, basically. I wasn't dealing with her policy stuff. I was taking calls from constituents. I was doing constituent casework. And so I was able to feel like we were doing good work at that time. It wasn't until a year later when she decided to run again, when I was like, okay, now I have to really do this calculus, this political career, but also moral calculus of, do I want to align myself with this person who I view as, exactly like you said, a stagnation of the Democratic Party? I say this a lot, whether it's Dianne Feinstein or Chuck Schumer or Joe Biden. We are allowed to, I think, celebrate and respect what some of these people have done in the past, positive things, some positive things, while also acknowledging that your time is done. And not only is your time done, but you are actively hurting the progress that we are attempting to make. And so when she decided to run again is when I said, thank you. I have, this experience was extremely valuable. I learned so much. It plugged me in. It gave me a foundation, but it's time for me to leave. And I left. But as you know, probably, I continued to operate in and out of both the progressive political spaces, but also ultimately back into very, very establishment, highest levels of that.
And that was that's my next question.
Yeah.
2024 campaign.
Yeah.
Why?
2024 or 2020?
The first one was 2020. Yeah, and then 2024, you came back too,
came
right?
Back, yeah.
Why?
Well, so for folks listening, 2020, the Bidens tried to hire me. I said no, because I was a Bernie Sanders supporter. They tried to hire me during the primaries. And I said, no, I'm supporting Bernie Sanders. Also, I like my work. A year later, when Biden won the primary, they came back to me.
What were you doing at the time?
I was at a political, progressive political media company in LA called Attention, ATTN. And my focus was on producing content, basically, that explained wonky progressive issues to audiences. If you remember the kind of like Vice, now this era of explainer content, that's what we were doing. That's what I was doing. And that's how I met most of the presidential campaigns, including the Bidens. That's because they would come to us for our guidance. After Biden won the primary, I said yes, and I became Dr. Biden, Jill Biden's digital director. And I moved around the country with them, and I traveled the country. We won, and I was in the White House for a while. But for 2024, to your question, it was almost the same thing all over again, which was when Biden decided to run again, I was completely out for a multitude of reasons, main one being Gaza for me. I just felt like it was there was many lines in the sand, many red lines. Gaza was the deepest. And it was similar. Members of the First Lady's team asked me if I would come back. I said, no, I'm not interested. Some folks on the digital team on the campaign asked me if I would come back. I said, no. And then when Biden dropped out and it switched to Kamala, you know, we all have our own, I don't know what happened, something psychologically for me. It allowed me to say to myself, okay, this is a binary option again. I'm going to get over that hurdle of this and I'm going to go in and just, I'm going to try to beat Trump. I'm not doing this because I love Kamala Harris. I don't. But given a binary option that we have right now, I think my time is better spent trying to defeat Trump than the other work that I was doing at that time.
Yeah, but Kamala, right? I think of her,
yeah.
I, even at the time, I saw her as an extension of Joe Biden.
100%.
And she was so explicit about it, whether it was Gaza or, again, calling Iran the axis of evil, mm-hmm. which we hear a lot.
Yeah.
There's always this dichotomy of, and we'll come to that, good Muslim versus bad Muslim. Have experienced it for the last 20 plus years, ever since came to the US. But then you were looking at the bigger picture. Right? You wanted to defeat Trump. What sometimes concerns me with the Democratic establishment, and I'm not saying this about you because you have a very different ideology and what you're doing now, everything becomes about Trump. We have to beat Trump. There is less focus on issues. There is less focus on problems within the Democratic establishment. If you ask me, as a progressive, I don't even call myself progressive anymore. I think I'm more on the left now. I see both Democrats and Republicans almost the same. And for me, it's like Democrats are probably lesser evil of the two, but that does not justify what they've done in the past, how they've treated minorities, how they create narrative around Muslims in this country. And yet for a lot of people, especially white Americans, the distinction is clear. You know, Democrats are a better party. Do you think it's because of privilege? Do you think it's because of your white privilege that you're able to see that and somebody like me doesn't see that distinction as clearly or is so disillusioned by Democrats that I don't feel like voting for them either?
Yeah, probably. That's probably part of it for sure. I also think that this is where my experience as an operator, when I say operator, I mean like being in the trenches of like trying to win elections. It changes the way I perceive politics, which is what you just said is the Democrats are one, as you said, you view Republicans and Democrats as like almost one in the same. Democrats are maybe the lesser of two evils. I completely understand that. For instance, let's talk about the uncommitted vote in Michigan or in Dearborn, Michigan, right? Like,
I do vote in every election.
No, totally.
Though.
But my view is like the folks who were uncommitted, that's a reality of politics. Like, okay, they're not going to vote because of they have their red line, because they view Democrats as similar to Republicans. It is not my job to shame them. It's my job to try to still win and prevent harm. The lesser of two evils thing, I think, is a very important piece of this, which is I do not view politics as like an optimistic program or project.
Although you started with Bernie.
Because that's what those, you know, people like Bernie or for me, AOC or Zoran, like there are these glimmering moments in people where hope is there.
And then reality hits and things change.
Absolutely. But I believe so much of politics is about harm reduction. I wish it wasn't. This is my own personal view. So much of politics is about harm reduction, especially when we're talking about, again, these systems and a country that is built on economic systems that are, whether intentional or not, built to commit harm to working people, to minorities, to et cetera. And I do view the Democratic Party as a fundamentally better option than the Republican Party. That is not to dismiss or justify the terrors and horrors that many Democrats have committed. However, when people say that Democrats are just as dangerous as Republicans, that's where I'm like, I can't agree with that.
Give me an example.
I mean, let's look at women's reproductive health care. Let's look at the rights of Black people to vote in the South. Let's look at queer marriage. Let's look at the industrial prison complex. Let's look at, I don't know, climate change and our reliance on fossil fuels. There is objectively one party that is worse on all of those issues. That is not saying that the Democratic Party as a whole is phenomenal on all of those things. They're not. But they are absolutely much better and fighting for these things that Republicans are not. And that delta to me is like, unfortunately, we do operate in a two-party system. And until that is changed, when we have binary choices, which is how I view it, once you get past the primary election again, when it was the primaries, I said, no, I'm voting for Bernie. I'm supporting my hope candidate. The moment the primary ends, you are left with a binary option for me. And then I view it as my role to help reduce harm. And that's the calculus for me. That's it. It's harm reduction.
Charlie, how do we change systems if we don't want to take those radical steps? How do we dismantle those systems? Because to me, it seems what's been happening for so many years in the U.S. is, in some ways, we are still preserving those stagnated, racially hierarchical, xenophobic, anti-Muslim systems in this country. And being a Muslim, I do feel it is so unfair. You've mentioned so many things about Democrats, right? You've given us a whole laundry list of how they're better, but you could not name how they treat Muslim community in this country, right? To me, if we don't do something radical, and by radical, I mean, yeah, sure, the uncommitted vote, I did not agree with it fully. I understood where they came from. And I also understood why they were holding back. What do you say to Muslims who've felt so betrayed by the Democrats and who are probably expected again this year in the midterms to go and vote for the Democratic Party, because that's the default setting we've been given now? As you said, it's a two-party system. We don't have another option. How do we get over that roadblock? And I know this is a difficult question. You're not Muslim, so you can't really speak to that, but you have worked within politics.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's a difficult question. I don't think the answer is easy, but I think the answer is what you said earlier, which is, and it's what I talk about so much in my content or my commentary, is the Democratic Party has completely lost the plot on anything, right?
Right.
Like, we don't know what Democrats as a party stand for anymore. To me, it's a policy failure. It's a policy position failure, which is, let's talk about Zoran, right? Like, to me, or Bernie, or whomever, like, there are, and of course, Bernie we know is an independent, but he caucuses with Democrats. Zoran, to me, is the perfect example of, like, what the Democratic Party should be. And I don't buy this idea that a lot of neoliberals say, or Republicans say, or Democrats say, where they're like, well, Zoran, well, it's New York. You couldn't do that another place. I say, fuck you. You do not understand politics, right?
True.
People forget that New York swung, it was the biggest swing to Trump of any district in the country. I think it was an 11-point swing to Trump. And then Zoran came in and pulled them all back. And he did build all of the subgroups that you're discussing, whether they're Muslims, whether they're the Black community, whether they're immigrants, whether it's the queer community, whether it's the Nepalese and Tibetan community in Jackson Heights, or the, I don't know, West Village finance guys.
Not sure about the West Village finance guys.
Well, he got some.
Though.
He did, right? I mean, he may not have dominated, but, like, my point is, they did build coalition, and that coalition wasn't just because people liked Zoran, it was because of what he stood for.
Right.
It was the policy positions, it was the worldview. And so that's my answer. The Democratic Party is not going to fix something by, like, having better talking points. It's about the candidates that we have, and we need better candidates. We need more progressive. And when I say progressive, I mean the Zoran progressive of humanistic, people-centric, empathy-driven, and actively working to uplift struggling people or communities who have been disenfranchised by both parties overall. I am concerned about this presidential election for this exact point, which is, I'm curious how you feel about somebody like AOC, of, like, the Democrats have a large bench of people who are going to run. There's not really any of them that I think can do
Absolutely.
I'm talking about.
Absolutely. I'm there with you. I know it's 2026.
Sure.
We are talking about 2028. I am not excited. I don't feel like I'm mobilized. I don't feel like I want to go out and vote for any of the current lot that we're seeing, whether it's Gavin Newsom or others. I am like, guys, give me someone better. As you said, maybe somebody like Zoran. But I do want to say this, Charlie, because now Zoran has become this, you know, symbol of what the Democratic establishment should pivot to. My worry with that is Democrats do that, right? For instance, when they lost elections in 2024, they were like, oh, we need a Joe Rogan of the left. And I was like, what the fuck? Is that how to attract more voters and bring them under this umbrella? My worry is this will become symbolic of something that they are trying to imbibe or, you know, copy or whatever you call it, and it will lose authenticity.
Yes.
Do you worry about that?
Absolutely. And I mean, that's that is what I try to hammer home in so much of my content, in fact, is like, you know, a lot of people, when they talk about Zoran's victory, they have a, and it's not to talk down to people, but I think like the discussion tends to be very surface level. Oh, he had great social media. Oh, his videos were so good. And it's like, sure, but all of that worked because of the underlying policy positions that right. he was running on. Without him, without his policies of free buses and free childcare and, you know, city-run grocery stores, none of the other stuff works, right? It's very similar to the Joe Rogan discussion of people who say we need, or who said we need a Joe Rogan on the left. Those people tend to misunderstand what Joe Rogan is.
Right.
Joe Rogan was not created in a lab. Joe Rogan was not a political or Republican commentator. Joe Rogan was a Bernie Sanders supporter who spent decades, building his platform, building community, building trust. And as we all know, politics is downstream from culture. He didn't grow his audience by talking about politics. He grew his audience by talking about aliens and conspiracy theories and MMA and bringing people in. And then when he would give his political opinion, people would listen, right? And so, no, 1,000%. I hear what you're saying of like the risk of like idealizing something and saying we need to go towards that thing. To me, that the risk isn't in doing that. It's the misunderstanding that you need to go towards authenticity, towards humanistic populist policy positions that benefit people. You can't just try to be like, oh, let's find a like brown, handsome guy who like speaks well and throw a good social media team at him.
And he smiles all the time. Yeah. His grin is so wide. I think that's deliberate. I think, again, being a Muslim, I feel like we have to smile all the time just to make people feel less threatened by us. I smile a lot. Even when I don't want to smile, I still smile. Mm. And I think that's a default setting that I've developed over the years. But you're right. You're right. I do want to pivot to your Instagram. Who is your audience, by the way? Did you have an audience in mind
yes.
when you did,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I know who that audience
sure.
is, but tell me.
It's the Joe Rogan listeners. The goal, the target, let's say, it is those like West Village finance guys, or it is the like bartenders in Iowa. It's normal people, normal guys. And by normal, I just mean like not obsessed with politics. That's all I really mean. That can be an entire spectrum of race and culture. That can be an entire spectrum of, you know, finances and economics, of sexuality. But I want men who are not seeking out politics and who feel like or are probably not being hit with the messengers who they relate to. My audience is, in terms of followers, is majority women. But I have a perspective on this that some people might call BS, but I think it's, I believe it, which is like, women hold so much power over men in terms of influence and persuasion.
Interesting.
And people can disagree with that. And this isn't me trying to like, you know, weaponize women for my own needs. But it's like, okay, sure. Let's say it's great if my content can flood the feeds of those guys. You know what's even better is if I can get women watching my content and then sharing my content with those guys. That is a victory for me. That is good. Hey, oh, hey, have you seen this guy? Or, hey, you should be like this guy. Or, hey, maybe you would like, I wish you talked like this. I wish you thought like this, right? Like, that is success to me as well. And that's not to say I'm not trying to talk to women or everybody. I want to talk to everybody. I'm not a journalist. I have an agenda. I am trying to drag people to the left. And that's what I want to do.
Yeah, so why is that demographic so important?
Thousands of reasons. I can only speak for myself. I think we all have our roles and we have our spaces and our responsibilities. And like, I need to be honest with myself. Like, I am a like white, Jewish, straight guy with a deep voice and a mustache who like drinks a lot of beer and has a lot of guy friends and goes to the bar and grew up playing football and baseball and rugby. And like, I look like and sound like a lot of the dudes who like Democrats are losing. Not just Democrats, but leftist ideas, leftist ideals, a progressive populist worldview. And I don't think that's because these men are not down for it. I think it's because there's not a lot of messengers who look like me or sound like me who are saying these things to them. That's why the whole conversation of we need a Joe Rogan of the left, I'm like, yes, like, duh. But like, that's also, again, to your point, like, it's a foundational misunderstanding of.
And you need multiple people, multiple platforms, right?
Absolutely.
That's what the right has done. They've really concentrated the airwaves. Like, you see podcasts and media, Substack. There's so many different through lines and touch points of where the right is. But back to your point, how do you relate to them? Setting politics aside, yeah. This demographic.
Yeah. I am them. When you talked about your, what does your husband do? What's his work?
He's a management consultant.
So like, I would love to tell you that like my entire community is like radical activists, artists. That's a part of my community. You know, who's also a lot of my good friends? Finance guys who live in the West Village, who I grew up with. Dudes who work for tech companies. Guys who work in hospitality. So for me, it's almost on the opposite of what I was talking about, the Zoran idea of like, there is value in identity when it comes to this stuff. There's value in, I'm not like putting on a face and being like, okay, now I'm like a bro. Let me talk.
Right.
Like, this is just me, right? And so I'm trying to be honest with myself, which is like, who are the guys that tend to listen to me? Who are my friends? What is that? Who are the guys who kind of tend to trust me? It's those guys. It's those dudes. Those are my kind of people. Maybe that means they'll listen to me more than they'll listen to the like wonky
Tucker
DC.
Carlson.
Yeah, exactly. Or Theo Vaughn or Andrew Schultz, right? Like that is the space I'm trying to get in, basically. Yeah.
Have you had any feedback on resonance?
Yes.
Give me an example.
I mean, a few. So there's always the question on social media of like, who is actually listening to, right? And we know that like we don't control the algorithms. Like the reality is probably the majority of the stuff I'm putting out there over time is being seen by people for the most part in our own camp or on our side. However, I am constantly, daily, getting messages from mothers who are saying, I love your stuff. I send all of it to my 19-year-old sons.
Oh,
every
wow.
Day. I've gotten
That's an achievement.
I've gotten messages, not just messages. I have had months-long dialogue with some of the biggest kind of like manosphere Republican commentators who I have gone after in my content. Those videos have gone viral. I then get messages from them that say, fuck, man, I think I fucked up. Can we talk?
And oh, then, wow.
So another example. I did a video when, if you remember, little Liam, he was a five-year-old child who got detained by ICE with his father outside of Minneapolis maybe 6 months ago or so. He had like a Spider-Man backpack. And I did a video basically thanking Joe Rogan, thanking Theo Vaughn, thanking Andrew Schultz for keeping us safe, for ensuring that criminals like Liam are no longer a threat to us, right? That video, the next day, was the number one trending topic on the Joe Rogan subreddit. Thousands of comments, overwhelmingly positive. People saying, oh shit, do you think Joe saw this? So I know that it's getting into those circles. I know that. I get DMs from men who say, thank you, I haven't thought about it like this. Or like, I was embarrassed to say these things out loud. You're making me feel more comfortable to talk about this stuff. It might be the minority, but it's happening, right? Like that's happening behind the scenes. And that's what keeps me doing it, really.
That's wonderful. We need more people like you, Charlie. Any plans to run for office? You're young. You can probably take another 10 years and decide, but still.
No.
Why?
That's not me saying I wouldn't.
Yeah, never say never.
Never say never. I was a behind the scenes operator until about 12 months ago. And I still do. I'm still a political consultant. I still have political clients. I see and know how the operational work functions to try to take people down, how the thousands of dollars to spend on opposition research happens, how those stories then get pitched to press just to fuck with somebody's life. And for the same reason that I am relatable to these men, I am not a clean person. I went to a state school. I partied. I've done drugs. Fun fact, I had to resign from the White House because I admitted to have smoking weed back in my life. That's why I left the White House.
Yeah, but we have Trump in the office.
Of course.
I don't see those offenses as a make or break.
Absolutely. It's not that I am It's not that I am scared of what's going to come out. It's like, it's more of like, that is, you have to make that decision for yourself of, are you okay? Do you want to be in the spotlight and you want to have like all, you want to have your life torn apart? And up until a year ago, I've never even had to consider that. And it wasn't until a year ago where I'm now getting people getting these questions, a lot of people asking me to run for office, where I've even considered it. So my answer is, it's not no, it's more like, it's never even been a thought until recently. And now it's a thought.
Now you've gone from being someone who shaped the message for powerful people, right? We've talked about this. But now you are the message. Mm. That's an identity shift.
Yes.
Who were you before you became who you are now?
I mean, I think I was the same guy. I don't think there's been much of a change. The change is that people recognize me on the street, that I'm like much more aware of being perceived. I went to a techno show last weekend. It was the first time I went kind of since, you know, really to really like let loose. And the moment I got there, a woman was like, I know you. And I was like, shit, like I went here to, you know, to just be an anonymous nothing in this warehouse. But genuinely, I think it's the same person. I think there was a bigger shift between like who I was when I was like in high school and college and who I was after, where once I really got into politics, basically, as an interest, not even as a profession.
Huh.
Yeah, I don't know. I need to ask my friends that if they think there's been a change.
What does your dad think of this trajectory?
My parents are, I think, ecstatic about this. Hmm. It's exciting. My parents are older. I've always been kind of protective of this, but, you know, I'll say it here, which is I've talked a lot about how in the last year I had to stop working because a family member got severely ill. That was my father. And
so sorry to hear
it's
that.
It's okay. You know, tis life. And it was a really brutal year for, of course, for him, for my mom, for me, for our whole family. But with that, there's been this very interesting binary of like, it's been probably the darkest 24 months for all three of us that we've all gone through together. And yet simultaneously, this is all happening. And it's provided immense joy and excitement for everybody. And so, and again, coming from a family of activists and advocates, I think they are extremely proud and happy. And, you know, I think there's a lot of things that led me here. Like the core foundation of what led me here is my parents. Like it is growing up in a unit, in a family where like it was normalized and encouraged to stand up, to protest, to get out there. I remember being five years old, marching in the anti-Iraq war protest, marching in the pride parades in San Francisco with like a little sign that I wrote with my dad, you know? So no, I think this has been like a real joy for them. And for me, it's a joy seeing how much of a joy it is for them.
In the end, if you were to define the United States of America in a sentence, a word, a phrase, how would you do that?
Wow. This might not be one sentence, but democracy is not a given thing. Democracy does not correlate with good or with optimism or with, and there is nothing in history that shows that democracy necessarily is always on a perpetual, positively increasing journey. Sometimes they break. Sometimes they crash and burn. Sometimes our most successful governments that centered people end up being the most disastrous and monstrous governments imaginable. And I think that my generation, maybe our generation, I should speak for myself, as a white guy who grew up in my generation, while things have always been shitty, there's felt like these minor increases of like things, oh yeah, this thing's getting a little better and this is getting a little better. And I think what the Trump era has done is forced people who are not Muslim, who are not queer, who are not black, who are not immigrants, to really have to understand and see that like this thing is fragile. It's never been great, and it requires everyone's endless work to maintain it. And that's what I think the U.S. is. The U.S. is not a promise of good. It's not a promise of prosperity, but is a reminder that in order to have peace, in order to have happiness, in order to have community, you have to always be working for that. It is an endless fight. So that's what the U.S. is. It is an endless fight to keep trying to get better.
So true. And thank you for saying that. Where can people find you and follow along?
They can find me at Chezchuk. It's at Chezchuck on Instagram and on TikTok. There will likely be some bigger projects coming soon, whether it's shows or podcasts, but nothing concrete yet. But yeah, right now, primarily on Instagram, TikTok, and wonderful shows like this.
Thank you so much, Ali. This was wonderful.
Thank you for having me. This was great.
You know, on Immigrantly, we talk so much about authenticity. But today's conversation is a great example of what authenticity looks like. Charlie is an incredible conversationalist. And when I sat down with him, I felt I was sitting down with a friend, talking politics and life in general. If you don't know about him or haven't started following him, you're missing out. This is one of those conversations that I really hope you enjoy and share with a friend, a family member, a skeptic, somebody on the right who isn't happy there but doesn't know where to go. If you have feedback for me, you can always DM me on my Instagram at @itsadiak. This episode was written and produced by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrantly's theme music is by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week for another important conversation. And be kind to others.